Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Again today with Noah Gibbs, author of Rebuilding Rails and Mastering Software Technique. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, I think this is our third episode together, if I remember correctly.
Is it?
Either the second or the third one. I can't
remember.
Yeah,
I can't remember either. I've talked to you just enough that I'm a little confused. It was such a good conversation. I've lost track.
Yeah, I'm glad that you don't remember either, because I felt a little guilty for not remembering whether it was two or three. But in any case, do you want to give a little intro of yourself for those not familiar with you yet?
Sure. You'll see the name Codefolio as my domain name and attached to me on Twitter. Rebuilding Rails, the basic idea is... You know that Feynman quote, what I cannot create, I do not understand? Basically, the way I think that you best understand Ruby on Rails is to build a framework structured like Ruby on Rails, an MVC framework. You go in and you build controllers, and you build, you know, sort of the basic plumbing to hook up a framework to your app, and you build views, and you build these things one at a time, one after the other, with a little working mini app. And by the time you've finished, you've generated a full, like a real MVC framework in Ruby. It's obviously not as capable as Rails, but it has a lot of the same features. It uses the same metaprogramming. A lot of what Rails does, you're actually well equipped after you've built this little toy thing to sort of jump in and read the Rails code and go, oh yeah, I know how this basically works. Yeah, this is a bigger version, but this does what my stuff does. So yeah, rebuilding Rails is understand Rails by building Rails. Mastering software technique grew out of me putting a lot of time into a non-coding discipline. I'll tell you what that was in a moment. And realizing that another group with all the same teaching challenges we had, that had been teaching a lot longer, did it a lot better than we did. So basically, it's like coding exercises, except, you know, no judgment if you don't do coding exercises. I don't do a lot of the standard kind of coding exercises myself. They don't work terribly well after you've been coding for a while. And so mastering software technique is like coding exercises, but they work. And you know, if you don't feel like paying me money, that's cool. My RubyConf talk was on that, and I recommend it highly. It's a great way to get started on that. But it's like coding exercises, but they work. I promised I'd tell you who I stole from. You know who else has way too many tools, and the number of tools is never again going to go down? Like, we have too many languages, too many libraries, is artists. Visual artists, you know, painters, people who draw with charcoal, those sorts of folks, because the number of tools they're dealing with is literally anything that can make a mark on another thing, like make a mark on paper, make a mark on anything that's not paper. But they have a small number of underlying concepts like composition and color theory they're trying to teach through that, just the same way that we've got concepts like modularity and data hiding. It turns out artists have a really straightforward kind of exercise that they use from pretty much the very beginning of being an artist up until they've been doing it for 40, 50 years or more. And it turns out we can just steal that directly. We don't even need to adapt it much. We can just do what they do. And so mastering software technique is pretty much, hey look, there's a way to do this exercise that does actually go through your career, and we haven't been using it, and we should really steal it.
Nice. And just curious, how long have you been doing the art stuff?
I'm not counting just kind of messing around on my own, which how many of us don't do tiny little bits of drawings occasionally, right? Mm-hmm. But I've been working more seriously on it for 2.5 or 3 years now. A little while.
Yeah, that's something that I've always been somebody who does at least some amount of art. My senior year in high school, somehow I managed to get 100% art classes. I had like
nice
drawing, sculpture, just all kinds of art, no gym class or anything. So, and then nice. as I've gotten older and accumulated responsibilities, I've done that less and less, but it's always something I've wanted to get back into. And I love when you can take something from one discipline and apply it to another discipline, and have that kind of mixing and maybe maybe realize things that you wouldn't have gotten just with the one discipline in isolation.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's always great when you can sort of move your understanding around and pick up interesting things.
Yeah, yeah. Something you and I were talking about pre-show, and I had like a little tweet storm about this, and I tried to make it into a blog post, but it didn't really work for various reasons. But I've had some connections between philosophy and programming. Mainly, like, I got interested in the topic of epistemology maybe a few months ago or a year ago. And so I got some books on epistemology and logic. And basically, epistemology, because I didn't know that word when I first started down that path, epistemology is basically like the methods of gaining knowledge, if I understand it correctly. And that seems like one of the very most useful things you can know, because it's the question of how do you know what's true and what's not true. If you're learning things, but you aren't doing a good job of separating fact from conjecture or just pure mistakenness, then that's almost worse than not knowing anything at all.
And a lot of that
comes back to programming, because like, if you have a bug, one of the most dangerous things is fooling yourself into thinking you know something you don't actually know. In other words, bad epistemology or invalid epistemology, invalid logic.
Yeah.
So I'd really like to distill that down into a blog post or something, but I sat down and tried it and I couldn't do it. Not capable of that yet.
Fair enough. Well, you know, keep playing around with it. I can think of three or four different things that would make a good, you know, blog post just from that description. But I suspect that any of the ones I wrote would be very different from what you've got on your mind. And that's half the fun, right? If you've got a general concept, there's no reason you can't take it three different directions and sort of see what feels good to you or what somebody else is interested in.
Yeah, what kind of things come to mind for you?
Well, when you say epistemology, I've taken formal logic classes a long time ago now, but you know, I know the basics. And one of the things about the kind of decisions we make as programmers is they're not actually formal logic sort of decisions at all. I mean, at the low level, at the code it is, but that's not most of what we're doing. If you look at, you know, software engineering, if you look at object-oriented design, if you look at modularity, almost all of those are closer to writing. Like writing words in English as a kind of decision than to formal logic, because it's about communicating with other humans. And so an interesting thing about programming is that it has strong roots in mathematics, which is an extremely simple, bare, stripped down, almost barren domain. You know, mathematics is not terribly expressive. Neither are early programming languages. Ruby is bizarrely expressive as programming languages go, and it's still enormously stripped down compared to even a very Spartan, very bare human language. And so the first thing that comes to my mind is that conflict between programming as applied epistemology or mathematics versus programming as applied human communication, which is a much squishier discipline.
Yeah. I've come to realize over the years that programming is much more art than people tend to talk about.
Yeah.
If you have a feature with very hard requirements, it's just a list of bullet points, probably no two programmers would implement it the exact same way. Even with something like Rails, where there's these very sharply defined slots where you fill stuff in. And I think that difference from programmer to programmer of how they would implement something is where the art part of it comes in, as well as, like you said, the part of the solution, the part of what gets created that communicates to your future self and to other developers, that part is art too. And I think a more fitting analogy for programming, it's often compared to building a house or a building. But that's not really...
Well, I was going to say that's not a bad analogy, but there's an awful lot of art in that too. But please, go ahead.
Well, I think a better analogy, at least in a lot of ways, is writing a novel. Because, like, think about a building. If you want to put an addition on your house, you don't necessarily have to change anything inside of your house. You can slap an addition on it, and there's nothing else has to change. Sometimes that's true of a program, but usually it's not. Usually when you add something to a program, it has ripple effects through lots of different existing areas. And to me, that's more like a novel, where imagine you have a character in the novel who has some personality trait, and you write the whole novel. Then you decide, like, oh, it's not an old man anymore, it's a young woman. And then you have to go back and see, okay, where are all the places in the book where an old man no longer makes sense, and the surrounding things have to change in order for it to make sense to be a young woman instead of an old man. So I think in that way, Sophomore is a lot more like a novel.
I agree with almost everything you said, except for you saying that that novels work that way and buildings don't.
Yeah, I didn't say that buildings don't work that way, but my one example was a case where it doesn't work that way. But yeah, you're right that in some cases you make a change to a building and you have to like go back and revisit a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the wonderful things about buildings is if you stop thinking of a building as something with an extremely bare, sparse, mathematics-like set of technical specs, if you stop thinking about it as though a realtor who didn't even have to sell it and certainly was never going to live there would think of it, oh, it's a 3-bedroom house, this many square feet, and you think of it as a place that people do things, suddenly houses are enormously complicated that way, and changing one area or adding another room can change the use of all the other rooms.
That's true, and a house is also a form of personal expression, and so there's a lot of considerations there. And like, the house might be built in the 1800s, and you add an addition in the 2020s. Well, you're going to have to make some choices about: do I want to use new materials that are like made to look the old way and match that, or do I want to like make some modifications to the existing house to make it match the new thing? You have to reconcile everything in that case. Yeah.
And so many of those questions, the answer is either, what do I want to do because I am the audience I care about, and what do I want out of that? Or what will other people think? In which case, you're communicating. You're attempting to speak to an audience, though of course speak is a bit loose when we're talking about making houses or even writing novels. But you know, you're deciding what other people think and what they'd like, and you're talking to that. You're figuring out how to express it. I think it's a Dijkstra quote. Code is written primarily for humans to read and only secondarily for machines to execute. Something like that. I'm probably getting it a little bit off, but
that's the gist of it.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's a lot of it, is it turns out that communicating with humans is so hard that if you add on the trick of getting the computer to do the thing you want it to do as an extra trick that you sort of do with your other hand while you're trying to do the actual task, you're still better off focusing on the actual task, because that trick that you're doing with your other hand, you can figure out how to do that. The first part is the hard part. Keep focusing on that.
The communicating with humans part is the hard part?
Yes, communicating with humans is the hard part. And so communicating with humans while writing a program that does what you want the computer to do, it's like communicating with humans while riding a unicycle. Like, the hard part's still communicating with humans. You'll figure out how to do it while riding the unicycle. Take some unicycle lessons. Like, it'll get to the point where the unicycle part is just mechanical. And in the same way, figuring out what you want the bits to do, what you want the data formats and things like that to do, it's like riding a unicycle. Eventually you get good enough at it that it's basically mechanical, and you're back to the hard part being communicating with humans.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. Like, after a while, programming gets really easy, and a lot of programmers like to congratulate themselves on how difficult programming is, which is true. I think the thing is, programming is really hard to learn just because there's so much stuff to it. But once you learn a sufficient amount of stuff, the act of programming is a high percentage of the time pretty easy. And I've found that like when I have a really low level of mental energy, I can program, but I can't like listen to an audiobook.
Yep. It's not if it's an audiobook you've actually got to focus on. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that there's, I mean, more than two kinds of programmers, but let's say inclusively two kinds of programmers. And some people are trying to get a basic job done with the code, and some people are trying to recapture that joy of trying to talk while riding a unicycle where you add constraints. And I think they just keep adding constraints to keep it difficult. And so they judge the power and ability that they have by how many constraints they can do it while still not necessarily talking well to other people, but, you know, the communication is still done to some basic standard. Now, how many constraints can you add while doing that?
What do you mean about the constraints?
Well, So if you look at code golfers, what they do is they pick a constraint that's so hard it can always get harder. Like, what's the tiniest, you know, way I can do that? Or people who write quines, you know, programs that print their own source code but print them in increasingly baroque and complicated ways. What they're doing is they're adding a more and more powerful constraint without worrying about the real-world usefulness of any of these things. They're taking out almost all of the communicating with people by using harder and harder machine constraints. And you can see the same kind of thing with, like, oh, and I'm going to do this in a declarative language that's structured like Prolog. Like, the hard part is figuring out how to think through these things like it's a logic puzzle. But what you are doing is something that would be easy in an easy language. And your pride comes from the fact that you did the same thing in a hard language. It's because early on, coding is like a logic puzzle. And if you keep adding constraints to make it harder and harder, it can be like a logic puzzle forever. But if you stop adding constraints, then at some point you realize you're good at solving logic puzzles. The logic puzzle's not that hard. Now, what am I going to do with it? And that's when you spend your time communicating with humans. Some people very intentionally never get there because they keep adding constraints instead of that.
Oh, interesting.
We don't have the other game in town. Sorry, we don't have the only game in town.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me now, the part that's still hard is, like, as an application grows, how do you keep the whole thing from just collapsing under the weight of its own complexity? It's kind of funny. There's the application that I've been working on for like the last 2 years. It doesn't really do anything all that sophisticated. It's like a whole bunch of CRUD forms. But yeah. When you have like 100 CRUD forms in an application, that becomes actually kind of a hard problem.
Yeah. Well, you've probably got a little bit of logic buried in between each of those steps. And the thing about 100 CRUD forms is that's an awful lot of trees to hide the forest between.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put that. Yeah, and so I've done some things like extended Form Builder, the Rails form class, extended that class so that I get more leverage out of it due to the fact that I have just a bazillion forms everywhere. I suppose at some point we should talk about our actual topic that we're going to be discussing, which is when to not use Rails. I think this started as something you tweeted or something I tweeted, and somebody said, hey, that would...
A random guy on Twitter that I follow actually tweeted about it. And I think you and I basically went, we'd talk about that. And then I said to you, hey, I'm serious if you are.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we are. I'll list my couple of things first, because Please. Sounds like you have more things than I do. And I only have two cases that I was able to think of.
Okay. Well, start with those.
Sure. The first one is almost not worth mentioning or not worth saying much about because it's so straightforward, which is just super small stuff. If you have a use case where you know it's never going to grow beyond something really tiny, if you just need some endpoint to exist online, you could use something like Sinatra. And I've done that before. I had an application where I don't even remember what it was because it was like 10 years ago now. But it happened to be a PHP application in this instance. But I didn't use a full framework. I just put a couple PHP pages up there, and that was completely sufficient forever. So that's one
totally.
Case.
Yeah.
The other case that I thought of is, I just thought of a third one. Okay. So number two is blogging. I would never build my own Rails application for a blog.
Solid.
Maybe if that blog had some really specific use cases, then I would. But just for like my own personal blogging site, I wouldn't. I haven't always used WordPress, but for a long time I've used WordPress. I hate WordPress with a burning passion, but I still use it for everything because it's the least worst tool the world has created for this use case so far.
It's up there. Yeah.
Yeah. A case could be made for something like Jekyll or something like that. And I was
going to say the other direction to go there is static HTML apps. My blog is actually built entirely as a built by Ruby static HTML site.
Okay.
So my favorite tool is Middleman because it looks almost exactly like Rails. And so if you're used to building Rails views with, you know, herb templates and things like that, it turns out Middleman is going to take you like 4 hours to figure out at most. It's just not that tough. And so, yeah, I've used a couple of different static site generators. Middleman's my favorite because your Rails understanding just ports right over.
Yeah, the significant thing being that it's a tool made for that job and it already exists and you don't have to build it yourself.
Yes.
Third one is marketing sites. So what I mean by marketing sites is like a dentist office needs a website. I would build that with something analogous to like WordPress, Squarespace, Weebly, whatever.
Yeah, the contractors that I know, or the freelancers that I know, tend to refer to those as brochure sites. They're sites that it's like you're paging through the brochure. They don't do anything terribly interesting. Maybe you've got a contact form, but mostly what it is a couple of static pages stuck together. And there's Rails is not going to buy you anything there.
Yeah, and that's a case where I would lean toward something like WordPress more than a static static site generator, because there's a whole ecosystem of plugins and stuff like that you can just grab off the shelf, and it makes your life so much easier than Rails. And you don't want to have to deploy an application every time you want to fix a typo or something like that, make a text change.
What I would say is that if I were actually going to sit down and do one of those, which occasionally I've done, almost always what happens is I go out and I find what I can get a good theme for. Because the visual design of the theme is so much harder than the back-end coding to make that work, that if I can find a well-designed theme, I'm just going to use whatever back-end that theme works with. There's going to be almost no back-end to it. So
that
whatever. But I might feel different if I were a visual designer. I assume I would feel different if I were a visual designer.
So those are my three things. What do you have?
All right. Sure. So, I mean, those are good. So just when I sat down to write it, some of what I wrote is a lot like what you did about very small things. And in fact, I would extend that even up through like API servers. Like it would have to be a fairly complicated API server for me to think that Rails was the right answer for it.
What exactly do you mean when you say API server?
Something that's a few REST endpoints that has no HTML generated, that is just going to serve like JSON or some other structured data format for the results, that's going to take a small collection of URLs. The kind of thing that if you do it with GraphQL, it would just be straight out of the box.
Okay.
Very often you want REST to serve as an interface to some parts of your database, filtered a little bit. So Active Record actually would be fine for that, but I wouldn't necessarily hook it to Rails. You can use Active Record separately, or you can use something like SQL, which is faster and sometimes simpler if you're not using Rails. You know, a lot of the reason Active Record is awesome when you're using Rails is that it hooks into things like forms. If you've got no forms, you don't care if it hooks into forms. It hooks into various kinds of like Rails plugins and stuff. But if you're doing almost nothing, you don't care what plugins it hooks into. So I would say in general, an API server, I wouldn't reach for Rails on my short list of things. I would look at something like Sinatra. As the number one on my list, unless I had a good reason not to.
Okay. What about like the back end for a single page application, client server architecture type thing?
Depends a lot on what the application is. I would do that case by case. The nice thing about Rails is I'm already familiar with it there. The downside of Rails is that Rails is very opinionated about its doing a lot more of things like the rendering. You don't have to have Rails do the rendering, but a lot of Rails doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense if it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently recorded another episode. It'll probably be the episode that comes out right before this. It was recorded with Matt Swanson, the Boring Rails guy.
And okay.
We talked about just how much benefit Rails provides between or on top of, like, so there's the layers, there's the database, the back-end Ruby stuff, and then the front-end HTML, CSS, JavaScript. And the benefits that Rails provides on the front-end are just absolutely enormous. And I mentioned in that episode people are now, I'm seeing questions sometimes in the Rails subreddit, like, hey, is it possible to build a Rails application and like not use React? And it makes me a little bit sad to see questions like that.
Yep. Well, I mean, the way that technologies are chosen is not necessarily directly about the tasks, and it's not necessarily directly about the, like you say, the boring value. You'll still see people who know what they're talking about reach for tools like Rails when they make sense. The nice thing about Rails is that it has a business niche that nobody else is even competing for.
What do you mean?
Well, so let's imagine for a moment that you are going to start a little Silicon Valley-style VC-backed startup. You've got a wild idea that you haven't properly verified with users. You've done a little early work, but you have not got it anywhere near what would be called product market fit. And so you know that you are going to be leading a small team in building a series of small sites where you slap it together, you try it out quick, you discover nobody wants to buy the thing, you throw all that code away, and you decide what the next thing they might buy is. And you know you're going to go through that cycle 8 times, 10 times, 12 times, you know, 30 times, which a serious startup is going to pivot repeatedly and is going to have smaller pivots many times in between. In other words, what you're doing is not dominated by technical risk. It's dominated by market risk. You're going to finish the thing, and mostly, no matter how good or bad the code is, the code wasn't the thing that mattered. Something else is going to kill it. Market risk is one great example of that. There are other examples. There's not a second choice anywhere near Rails. Like, what else would you even consider using for that?
Yeah, isn't it crazy that that is still the case? Rails was created in 2004 and open sourced in 2005, if memory serves. So that's a solid 15
right.
years ago.
Yeah.
And still, based on my very like tenuous grasp on how viable the other options are, how close they are to Rails, it seems like maybe Laravel is the next, the closest thing to like the ethos of Rails. It's surprising that there's not a lot more.
Yeah, Laravel and Django are the two things that I would look at with a straight face and say, you know, if for some reason Rails wasn't appropriate, maybe one of these. Yeah, both of those seem like solid choices. A lot of what, as far as I can tell, is going on there is that Rails has one massive non-obvious advantage that other people just don't see. And that massive advantage is security.
Interesting.
Like, there are two very solid types of teams that I would look at and say, you need Rails. One is a small, sharp team of people who are going to do weird shit.
Okay.
Those people should be working in Ruby. You work in Ruby enough that I don't have to tell you why. You understand. Those people should be working in Ruby. It's what, in the Rails doctrine, DHH talks about, you know, sharp tools. Those are the people who should be using sharp tools. Those people should be working in Ruby or something like it. You can do it in Python, but you're swimming against the current if you do that. Python tells you not to do that kind of thing, even while allowing you to do it. And so you're going to find that you're the only one doing it in a big room full of Python programmers. Whereas if you're in a room full of Ruby programmers, you know, they're all trying that, and most of it comes out terrible, but that's okay. 90% of everything is crap. It's, you know, the other 10%, how good it turns out, that determines whether it was a good idea to do anything weird. Ruby is full of weird things that work out incredibly well. That's what it's good at. And so if you have a tiny team of sharp programmers doing something weird, Rails. Again, there's nothing else comes close. Rails. The other kind of team that Rails is phenomenally good for is if you've got a mediocre group of people. They don't have deep understanding of SQL necessarily. They don't have deep understanding of the exact, you know, CSS and JavaScript. Like, these are not extremely sharp, extremely senior people. And you want to cobble something together that is good enough rapidly and then verify the market opportunity. And security is the massive advantage for that kind of team. Because if you're going to take a team of people like that, where none of them are elite security experts, you don't have an elite security expert. You don't even have the budget for an elite security expert. And you're going to have those people build an HTTP interactive user-facing app and put it up on the World Wide Web so that people can hammer on it with all kinds of weird requests. Where's your second choice? Who's in second place behind Rails? Because they're very far behind.
Yeah. I don't know any other frameworks in enough detail to be able to make a comparison, but I can compare it to like vanilla PHP, for example. if somebody built a PHP site that's not even on any framework at all, that's unsecure by default, whereas Rails is secure by default.
I would highly recommend reading through the Rails security guide. I would highly recommend just reading through it, because it's a wonderful combination of all the stuff Rails can fix for you with all the stuff that they tell you about how you have to fix it, because some stuff Rails can't fix. But if you want to see how seriously Rails takes security, look at the transition from Rails 3 to Rails 4, where they added strong params, where because even the big outfits like GitHub were not routinely validating their parameters properly. It's, you know, quote, simple, unquote, but nobody was doing it. Not even the serious teams were doing it, which means that it was the kind of thing that has to be fixed in the framework. And they broke compatibility on all the controllers currently in existence for Rails, basically. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little, but only a little. Like, that breaks essentially every Rails app, because it breaks every Rails app that does mass assignment, that assigns more than one field at once. That was how important it was in the Rails 4 transition, almost nothing changed. That could have been a beautifully painless transition from Rails 3 to Rails 4. All they had to do was not ship this massive security thing. What did they do? They shipped the massive security thing. They broke everybody.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting their stance of like valuing making things good over backward compatibility. Because that's a case where... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, that's a lot of what defines not only Rails, but Ruby.
Okay.
I mean,
I was unaware of that as it pertains to Ruby.
So how much Python do you know?
Very little.
If you were to take Python and run it through the front end and get what's called the abstract syntax tree of Python, just its set of operations, you know, add this, define this method, do this kind of thing. And you did the same thing with Ruby, and you looked at those two abstract syntax trees for real programs that are written there. They're almost like long-lost twins. They do such similar things in such similar ways. The syntax is different, but the basic operations, the level of the language, you know, what kinds of operations they allow and disallow, are so similar between Ruby and Python. It's very different from a low-level language like Java or C. It's very different from a language like Haskell, which is a different flavor of high level. Ruby and Python are extremely similar in what they do and how they do it. There's a reason that the performance communities of the two languages are run in very close parallel, where, you know, if you're not sure what to do in Ruby, you look over in Python and see if they've fixed the problem yet. And in Python, they look over at Ruby and see if we've fixed the problem yet. What we are doing is so similar. And the communities are so enormously opposite, just night and day different.
Much different. I went to a Python conference once in Nashville. This was last February 2019. I managed to get a talk accepted at a Python conference, even though it didn't have anything to do with, well, it was kind of technology agnostic. Anyway, it was a different experience. It wasn't like better or worse necessarily, but it was a palpably different culture.
Yeah. So what I tend to say is, Ruby went through the whole Ruby 1.8 to Ruby 1.9 transition, where we broke all the things to get a substantially better design for the language. And in so doing, we essentially broke all the old Ruby code, all of it. Python, of course, is trying to do that with Python 2 to Python 3. And one of the big differences is in Ruby, we declared that and we went through it, and it was an enormous amount of pain, and everybody hated it. And it was a giant thing that took, felt like forever to do, 5 years, 6 years. And at the end, we did it. And in Python, they never did it. That has never successfully happened.
What is the story with the Python 2, 3 thing? Because I still don't understand.
I mean, Python 3 is their Ruby 1.9. It's going back and finishing fixing a lot of things that had it originally been designed that way, they could have fixed. And Ruby 1.9 was the same, right? It's like if you pretend you had Mats, who was able to predict the future, he could have gotten to the stuff he eventually figured out a lot sooner. And if you had a Guido van Rossum, who could predict the future, he could have gotten to the stuff that he figured out a lot earlier. It's the nature of the job, right? Like, they get better while doing it, and then they eventually figure out how to do it better. The thing about Python to remember is that Ruby is very centered on web uses, and they're very used to breaking everything regularly.
Like, what do you mean by breaking everything?
We add new tools and we change how everybody does everything on a regular basis. Bundler goes from not existing, like being written for Rails 3, to being how many Ruby projects exist that don't use Bundler. in a shockingly short number of years. I mean, faster than the Ruby 1.9 transition. We went from there is no bundler to everyone uses bundler incredibly rapidly. Rake, same kind of deal. Like Rake didn't exist, and then it did, and then everyone used it. Gems, Ruby gems, didn't exist, and then built into the language. And yeah, there have been a lot of transitions like that. Ruby people are very willing to say, we've changed how we do it. We're breaking the old way of doing it. We're fixing all the code. And that's an extremely good match for the web, because browsers do that same thing. Browsers screw with stuff. Web servers screw with stuff. They change the interface to these things, and you just have to roll with it. You know, Google says, no, really, everybody's going to support HTTPS from now on. That's not optional. Everybody has to go out and support it, and it's going to take you a certain amount of extra work to fix it. You don't get to say no. You don't get to say, no, actually, all my old stuff is running out here. Like, if you do, then increasingly stuff doesn't work with you. New stuff doesn't work with you. A lot of the old stuff doesn't work with you. We're updating everything. And if you're not updating, then you are left behind completely. Not in the way that old television episodes are in black and white, but in the way that old Apple II video games are not mostly playable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And that's a good point that it's like a good fit for the web to kind of replace the old way with the new way on a regular basis.
But where does Python win over us enormously? Come on, what's the domain where you look at Ruby and Python and like Python is so far ahead of us, it's not even funny?
Well, like science and academia is the answer. Bingo. I'm aware of.
Yes, that is the answer. That is the one I'm looking for. And you know who still wants their 20-year-old code to run? Mathematicians. Mathematicians and scientists do not want to have to go back and revisit all their old research papers every 20 years. Like, no, that's a complete non-starter. And in Ruby, it would be a lot shorter than 20 years. It'd be like 10 years, 5 years.
Yeah, interesting.
You need an old artifact of the research to still mean something and be basically usable. I talk about Java as the utter polar opposite of Ruby on this one. I sometimes kind of jokingly refer to it as COBOL 2.0. And that's because, well, COBOL has 50 and 60... 60 years, I think, at this point, old software is still running, but an enormous quantity of like 40 and 50-year-old software is still running. There's a lot of it, and it still runs. It runs fine. And if you ever pick up a COBOL Programmers magazine, that's not an electronic thing. I'm not talking about a website. No, they have physical paper magazines because we're talking about COBOL programmers here. It's plastered down both sides with ads for mechanical COBOL translators to turn your COBOL code into another language, but it is always the same other language. You know what language it is?
Yeah. I have a guess.
Yeah, Java. Yeah. Java, of course it's Java. And it's because Java has backwards compatibility literally back to Java 1.0 for bytecode and source code.
Wow.
Yeah, nobody else does that. If you're going to write code in any modern language that's going to run 50 years from now, that modern language is Java.
Yeah.
Not a short list.
This is not the first time this has come up on the podcast, and I can't remember if it came up with you or Sandy Metz or Charles Nutter, or if all three of us talked about it, but this has come up before.
I definitely beat that drum. It could easily have been me. I could believe it was either of those other two. I mean, Sandy Metz has enough perspective that she thinks in those terms, so it wouldn't shock me if it was her, but I beat this drum a lot, so probably was me too.
Yeah, and it makes sense because it's the similar deal to the academics who want their code from 20 years ago to still do the same thing now.
Yeah, well, it turns out you do this stuff and 10 years from now it won't work anymore is a major problem for most disciplines. Like,
yeah.
Most people consider that kind of a non-starter, right? It's like, pretend you looked at houses and they said, oh, you can build this, but in the next 10 years you're going to have to tear it down and build a new one. I don't know what technology that would be offhand, but I know you would be really leery about using it for your house.
Yeah. Yeah, there's kind of like two use cases of code. One is where you like want to build something and you want it to just work forever and you don't want to maintain it. And then there's the other kind of thing where it's, well, you know, websites are often, web applications are often referred to as services, which is a good word. Because a service is something that word implies that there's people continually maintaining it, being actively involved with it, changing it, stuff like that. And so for a service, it makes complete sense to have something that you have to keep painting over many times in order for it to keep working. That's only not only, it's not only not a problem, but it's like just part of how the whole thing works, and it's a good thing. Yeah. I've never really thought about that distinction before.
There's some wonderful work by Jess, who is Jessitron, Jessica Kerr. Yeah, you had an interview with her. Mm-hmm. You've interviewed some great people. And she talks about semathesis. She talks about sort of learning systems made of learning components, where those learning components are a combination of people and software and other stuff. And that's the same kind of thing she's talking about, is in a case where a lot of the system is necessarily in the form of knowledge in the people or slow change of software over the years as people adapt it. Like you say, that's a service. It's a little like a car wash, right? Like in some sense, the car wash is an artifact where if you just all walk away from it, somebody could drive up to the car wash and still use it for a while. But if all the people that maintain the car wash are gone, the writing's on the wall. Like it's only going to last so long, and it's not long.
Yeah. Yeah. Something, you know, sometimes I find it interesting to think about the things that I didn't realize when I was a kid that I know now as an adult. And this is something that has been highlighted very, very noticeably recently, which is in order for the world to run, people have to keep it running every day. And if people stopped, then everything would stop. And obviously my reference was to the coronavirus stuff, where a lot of stuff stopped happening, at least for a while. And a lot of stuff is still stopped. But yeah, like a car wash, if everybody walked away, it would work for a little while, and then stuff would start to break, just like an application. For some reason, it's like harder for people to understand this with web applications as opposed to something like a car wash. Like the average person would probably concede that a car wash wouldn't last if you just walked away from it for 6 months. But a web application, there's kind of an assumption that you have to build it once and that's just all that it takes. But no, it of course takes maintenance.
Well, so when I'm talking to kids, including my kids, but really any kids, and I'm trying to explain that they could be a computer programmer and explain what being a computer programmer is and what it does, the hard part, the first thing I've got to do that most people, even most adults, don't really get, is that software is a thing that people make and they have to go through the process of making it. Like when you see a wrought iron stairway, you see the rails and handrails and things like that. Like most people kind of get that at some level that is a thing that people had to make. And even if it's somehow mass manufactured, the original thing that was mass manufactured, some human being had to think about and design. And most people don't truly get that about software.
I don't know if I've encountered that.
Well, so like, if you get a chance to talk to someone who is seriously not a computer person, not a software engineer, not working in computers, whatever they do, it's not computers. And you shouldn't have too much trouble finding one of those. The world is mostly made of them. But you talk to somebody like that, sit down with them at some point and have a look at the thing that's on their screen on the computer and talk to them about how each of those little boxes, each of those windows, has to come from an application that a human made, and at some level a human has to decide exactly where every dot goes. I mean, that's a collaborative effort. You've got people who figured out how the font works, and you've got other people who figure out how to put the text in boxes. But try talking to them about the idea that humans had to figure out how to arrange those lines on the screen and arrange those dots in the letters and arrange, you know, how the little windows show up on the screen and when they pop up and when they don't and when one's over another and you know, how it works with the mouse cursor. Like, most people don't really think of the mouse cursor as a thing designed by a human. It feels like an extension of your arm, right? Even more so with a touchscreen. The idea that a human has to tell that how to move, it's almost impossible to even explain. Sit down and try and explain it sometime. It's eye-opening.
Yeah. And something that I wonder sometimes is how much of this stuff is inevitable and how much of it is not. Because I bet there's more of it that was not inevitable that seems inevitable. Seems inevitable that we would have a mouse. But maybe not.
No, if you look at the story of the mouse, that was one that could easily have sunk. I mean, the whole mouse idea was one. You can thank Steve Jobs for popularizing that, and you can thank the people at Xerox PARC for designing it. But an awful lot of the stuff they did at Xerox PARC took a very long time to get popular or just never did. And some of what they did is a better idea than what happened and could have had, you know, could have had a Steve Jobs that went, I'm gonna take that and do it in my thing. But for whatever reason, never did.
And just to take this tangent that we're currently on and make it even more tangential, sometimes I think about all the alien civilizations that must exist, and I wonder what kind of inventions do they have that we also have, and what do they have that seems inevitable to them that we don't have? But also, you know, something that only makes our technological civilization possible is like the morphology of our bodies, because dolphins, for example, have an intelligence that is maybe comparable to ours, but they don't have hands, and so they can't make stuff. This is a weird sounding idea, but if you somehow had dolphins' brains inside human bodies, maybe there would be some more tool usage and stuff like that. It probably obviously wouldn't come out the same way that we have, but it would probably be pretty interesting. They just don't have the capability.
Yeah, it's like dealing with an octopus. One of the cool things about an octopus is they've evolved it's hard to measure intelligence when it's too different, but they have a roughly human-ish level of intelligence of a completely different form, independently evolved in a different way for different purposes. And yet they can do things like playing fetch.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I did know that an octopus can, like if you put a treat inside of a jar and give it to an octopus, into a closed screw top jar, the octopus can figure out how to open the screw top jar.
And what's interesting is that's a hard one for them, and so they tend to only figure it out if they really like the treat.
Interesting. Yeah, and that's something that a baby probably couldn't figure out.
Yeah, and it's so when you talk about the morphology of the body, like separating that from the mind is not just very difficult, it's almost certainly impossible, because so much of your thinking is done as a team effort. So much of what you're doing is a cycle between, I have an idea, I try a thing, I make a mistake, the mistake inspires me. But that whole try a thing, make a mistake is all interpreted through the morphology of your body.
Yeah.
The kind of mistake you make depends on the body you have.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, so right,
it's
one of the great, and we're not done yet. One of the great tragedies of existence is that, well, almost certainly, never have any sort of contact with any alien civilization. So we won't get to find out what would be a fascinating answer, which is what kinds of civilizations elsewhere in the universe have a morphology that makes them capable of building a civilization that is somewhat like ours, and what does that look like, and what kind of stuff do they have?
It would be different if they weren't like primates. Look at octopuses, man. It's an independently evolved set of intelligence that happened as a side effect of dexterity. I've got a friend who's a squid researcher, and talking to her is wonderful that way. She wrote a book called Squid Empire. If you ever want, you know, sort of the entire family tree of squid, you probably didn't, but you know, it exists.
I do, because my squids are my son's favorite animal. So
well. The thing I'll say about cephalopods in general is they're incredibly smart, and that seems to have evolved as a side effect of dealing with all those arms.
Interesting.
So while if you look at like chimpanzees and parrots and the other things that are kind of on our side of the evolutionary tree, primarily intelligence seems to evolve as a side effect of adultery and politics games.
Mm.
Octopi are mostly solitary. And so they don't do that. But they need massive intelligence to run all those arms with the extremely flexible body morphology.
Well, my understanding is, which is not an incompatible understanding from what you said, is that intelligence is driven, at least one of the things that drives the development of intelligence is social hierarchies and maneuvering the social hierarchies, which kind of relates to what you said about adultery and I forget what else.
And politics like, games. Yes, we're talking about the same things.
Yeah exactly.
Pardon me one moment.
Mm-hmm. The I don't know. I saw some nature show where they were talking about groups of primates, and the level of intelligence that the primates evolved over time was directly proportionate to the size of the groups that those primates lived in.
Sorry, just got back, so I missed a little bit there.
Oh,
when I
okay.
said, excuse me a second, I actually I disappeared to go help a toddler.
I was just I was talking about the size of the groups of primates in this nature show I was watching, and like the size of the groups that they would live in was proportionate to the intelligence that they evolved over time.
Yes,
and it's amazing how much of daily life, it's very non-obvious, but once you get into it and consciously think about it, you see it everywhere. Everything we do today is driven by those traits that developed in response to the need to maneuver in the social hierarchy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, another way to say exactly the same thing is that human social hierarchies have to be shaped like the human body and mind.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about that part of it in combination with that, but I guess that'll give me something to noodle over, and maybe we should get back to our main topic now.
Sure. Well, you've got some more fodder for that philosophy post eventually. You know, there are probably 10 blog posts worth of random stuff in all that. But yes, we can talk about Rails again.
Yeah. So, how many of your items in your list did we get to before we went on like that 15-minute tangent?
Not very many.
I think it might have been one.
There's two of them that are kind of, but somewhere between one and three.
Yeah, that's funny. You're a dangerous guest to have on the show because tangents are kind of my weakness. It takes very little for me to go off on a tangent, and you are a very willing co-conspirator.
Well, you ask great questions. You ask, I could sit around and noodle on completely random topics like squid intelligence like all day. That'd be awesome. Okay, well, so let me hit my list quick. I had a really quick list that I first did when not Rails. So first one is team familiarity and hiring. You know, when would you not do Rails? If you have trouble getting Ruby programmers or you don't already have Ruby programmers, obviously not Rails then. Like you say, really small tasks, like just an API server. We talked about API servers. You talked about brochure sites, that kind of thing. You wouldn't use Rails for something where the complexity didn't warrant it. Rails has a bunch of complexity, and in return, it gives you massive features. And if you don't need the massive features, skip the complexity. The next thing I had on my list, very large team or a very large code base, are both things Rails is not all that happy with.
Interesting.
So the thing about Ruby, and when I talk about, sharp tools and the really interesting team of people doing weird stuff, is that all of that's about non-local effects. All of that is about warping the language to better suit your domain. And the thing about warping the language to better suit your domain is you can only have so many sorcerers warping the language before you discover that you're conflicting horribly. Think about monkey patching. Monkey patching is kind of the definitive example of this. It's incredibly powerful in tiny doses. And once you've got about four people doing it so that they're not all talking to each other anymore, everything blows up.
Okay. Yeah, I can easily imagine how that could lead to a blow up.
So if you have a very large team, and again, this is yet another place where Ruby and Java are social opposites. Java is designed so you can't have all that many non-local effects. There's only so much somebody else on your team who is not good at what they do can cause you serious trouble. And Ruby is designed to need massive trust. Somebody else who's far away on the team can help you enormously or hurt you enormously, which is great if you have a small team of very good programmers and terrible if you have a large team of people you only sort of trust. Or are only sort of communicating with, which is the same kind of thing. So a very large team or a very large code base, Rails tends to get bad. The other thing with large code bases, something I haven't said here is a place you wouldn't use Rails is when there is a different framework that is a better match for your needs, which isn't necessarily about Rails. It's about, what else exists. But very large teams and very large code bases, there are other things that start to be designed for that in a way Rails is not. So Hanami is the really obvious thing there. Hanami is designed in kind of a hexagonal Rails style, like we're going to make you do a little more configuration. We're going to make you declare a little more of what you're actually doing. We're going to make you go through a little bit more ceremony. And in return, you can have multiple different databases that are completely separate from each other, so that if you're messing with your Active Record configuration, it doesn't screw with something else database-wise that somebody else is doing on the same project. Like, it has a lot of ways to have more modularity at the cost of a little more ceremony, a little more working on things, which is great for a very large code base. If you have a lot of controllers or a lot of services or something like that, you absolutely want that trade-off. And you can find a lot of consulting companies and other people who deal with very large Rails apps that have a full set of rules to do that in Rails, because a whole bunch of people use Rails and now they have to make that same for a large code base. But an easier way to do it is often just not to use Rails in the first place if that's what you're doing, because that's not really what Rails is designed for. Like, if you look at the initial Rails projects out of, say, Basecamp, a lot of them are not large. And where they have interesting large functionality, they deal with that by splitting it up into smaller pieces, which, again, is wonderful for things like monkey patching and other sharp tools, where if you've got too many of them happening in the same space, everything blows up. Well, great. First thing you do is separate the spaces so they're small spaces, and then you can keep all the weirdness that you're doing in your head for any one of those spaces.
Yeah. Something that I've come to realize is that, like, an application can... Well, there's obviously multiple different kinds of applications, but there's like two categories of applications that I have like identified in my mind, which I think are useful identifications to make because your sure. interests are going to be different depending on which kind you have. So sure. I think I even talked about this last episode also, but like something like Twitter, not a heck of a lot of depth to that application, at least for the average user, but massive okay. scale. Okay. And then there's something like the application that I'm currently working on, only a couple dozen users, but huge, relatively small number of users, but large number of features in the application.
Yeah. So traditionally, that distinction you're making is a lot like the whole B2B, B2C distinction.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar.
Right.
Traditionally, yeah. Business to business tends to have very complicated requirements on what the features are, small number of total users. You need to develop well, and you also don't have a lot of profit per feature, even if you have a lot of profit per user. And so very often you need to find something where you can prototype really quickly and your server costs are going to be low. You know, if you're running this for 40 users, it turns out it doesn't matter if you're a little bit inefficient on it because you're only going to repeat it, you know, 40 times a day rather than if you have 4 million users simultaneously and you're repeating it 4 million times a day.
Yeah. Or maybe the profit is concentrated in a small number of the features, which is actually probably true of a consumer app too. But in this app, I can think of a couple features where it's like, they are so incredibly central to the workflow and like so many dollars are flowing through those few features. And there's other features where it's like they get used. They need to be there, but you just build them once and never touch them again. And they're really simple and they were easy to do. People use them like once a week and just that's that.
Yeah. And what I would say there is if Ruby has an obvious home, it's either B2B or B2C with a small early user base. Once you get to massive scale B2C, once you're dealing with something where there's not a lot of resources, not a lot of margin per user, where you have a small number of features that don't change much anymore, you're suddenly paying a lot of processor cycles and a lot of memory to do it Ruby's way when you're not actually going to need the flexibility that it gives you. You're paying for a feature you're not using.
Yeah. And if you get to the point where you're in that position, then consider yourself very lucky. You're among the rare case because most cases... Most applications aren't going to get to that scale, right?
Yeah. No, only a very few applications from only a very few companies ever get to that scale. Now, someday I want to write a Ruby performance book and title it The Upward Path to Ruby Performance. And the thing is that if you look at the application over its life cycle, not the application, not one user's life cycle within the application, but the life cycle of the application itself, Ruby is very much aimed at the early part of that life cycle.
Right.
It's not that it can't work in the later part, and there are some times where you still need it in the later part. But by and large, when you think of Ruby, you think early life cycle. And so a lot of it is start really inefficient, and then you want something like Ruby that is really good at profiling, so you can find out what the slow parts are and start swapping them out. You know, you discover that you're doing something that's slow in Ruby, and then you move it into the database. You discover that you're doing something that's slow in Ruby, and you move it into a backend service. You discover that you're doing something that's slow in Ruby, and you set up a NoSQL store and push it there. You discover you're doing something slow in Ruby, and you put it into CouchDB. Part of Ruby being such an amazing glue language, one of the effects of that is there's a strong tendency when you're building something, you mock it up in Ruby because Ruby is so easy to write. And then once a feature stops changing much and stops moving much, now you look at maybe you can move it out of Ruby one piece at a time. And that way you've got this small core, which again, Ruby excels at a small core. Ruby does not want to be giant and sprawling. And so each one of these things you can take out of Ruby one at a time as they mature, as you figure out what they're doing, as you no longer need that flexibility. That keeps your Ruby core small, so you can keep changing things in the small number of areas where you need the flexibility, and the kind of thing that you can just do in a database because you now understand it well enough. You've got a set schema. You've got a set of operations that you do on it. At some point, you stop changing the interaction and you can just hand off, here's what we're doing, to like a DBA. And a DBA can suddenly design that into an excellent, beautiful, tight little database schema. But you go through a lot of Ruby and a lot of changing things on the way there. I actually ran an analytics group in Ruby at a company called OnLive that did cloud gaming. And a lot of the analytics we did was in Ruby because I didn't know what I was doing. I don't mean because I was choosing the wrong tool. Actually, Ruby was a great tool for this. I mean that a lot of the data exploration I was doing was new. I was using slightly weird kinds of data in a way where there wasn't already an established way to do it. And so what I wanted was to be able to write these queries really quickly and have the results turn around and come back in a way that, you know, where I had a lot of flexibility there. And then once I figured out that a particular query was important, then I could bake it into a tool like, you know, Esper, which is a Java event engine. That could calculate the result much more efficiently over time, could keep calculating and recalculating the result a lot faster and a lot better. But I needed that Ruby stage to figure out what was important and what was worth putting this extra effort into the calculation engine.
Got it. That reminds me of the saying, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly at first.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a lot like what people say about CEOs. Any job that's worth hiring for is worth spending time doing a bad job at for 2 weeks yourself so that you know what to hire for.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that principle, and that's definitely a good idea.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, one of the items on my first little list is established domain, B2C type user base, high server costs due to many users. Like that's a time, when I say established domain, I mean, you already know exactly what you want to do. You're not exploring a lot, you know it. B2C type user base, I mean, low margin, massive number of customers. So you don't want to have a lot of server costs per user. And thus high server costs due to many users is the same thing. So yeah, that's the other place where Rails is not necessarily the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the application I'm working on grows over time, because as it gets bigger, Rails is less helpful. The Rails part is still enormously helpful. Just that the more stuff you add, the more you're wandering off of the path that Rails was intended for. And so it's on you to come up with your own solutions at that point.
Yeah. You will eventually have unique needs for a whole lot of features because you will have actually used your app, you know, played with your app enough to say, oh, hey, this is important to me. This needs to be custom built for my use case. The problem with doing that say you just skip the framework entirely and you custom built it entirely in Ruby or Java. The problem is that if you just do that, trying to reason about it from first principles before you have any user behavior, is you're going to build the wrong thing. But eventually, you're going to need this beautiful custom app that does everything in its own way. It's just going to take you a long time and a lot of observing actual users to find out what the right way is to do it for the app.
Yeah, I've been building what is basically a new framework, like a child framework of Rails, or an extension of Rails, or however you want to put it. And I've been building my own libraries that like conceivably could be open sourced or whatever. Because that's the kind of thing that arises out of this kind of application.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds like you were going to say one more thing. I'll let you say that. And then after that, probably time to transition into our final question, which is where can people find you online and stuff like that. But did you have a thought that I interrupted?
Let me look and see if there's anything else. So when I say my first little list, it turns out I had, another actually large list that we're not going to get to at all. But I will say one more thing about when Rails or not Rails that we haven't touched on really at all. Because again, it's about what else exists, and that's evented frameworks. That's something like Node.js or Go. If you've got something that does very little calculation or data transformation, and it's just sort of shuffling together events from several different things, like a backend data store or another API that it's a gateway to, Rails is actually completely the wrong choice. For that, you want something like Node.js or Go that is really good at holding a very large number of connections open and very quickly putting together things in simple ways. Whereas Rails, its basic architecture assumes you're doing some interesting calculation.
Ah, got it. Okay.
So it's been said. Anyway, sorry. That was, if I had one more thought, that was the one more thought. So
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Last question at this point. Where can people find you online, including we'll put links to all this stuff in the show notes, but I guess we've already mentioned Rebuilding Rails and Mastering Software Technique. I'll put up links to both those things, but where can people go to find you online?
So I have a blog I write on very regularly at Codefolio, CODEFOL.io. And you can find pretty much all my other stuff from there. I'm also lately putting together a little courseware thing called Ruby Mad Science. Right now, it's just kind of an article series on Codefolio. So if you look at Codefolio, you'll find it. But I'm trying to turn that into something interesting as well. Codefolio is the easy way to find me.
Awesome.
You can also find me. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
This has been a very enjoyable conversation. And I've learned a lot from this, and I hope the listener has too. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. We should do this again, sometime soon.
Let's do it. All right, cool. Talk to you later.
Bye.